We're in chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes, and I'm going to read the first 8 verses, only because it's an old bird song and I hate to just break it up, you know. Those of you who remember the birds, funny you get saved and find out where they got their words from. But a beautiful piece of poetry. So let's read the first 8 verses, then we'll back up. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, and a time to die. A time to plant, and a time to pluck up that which is planted. A time to kill, a time to heal. A time to break down, and a time to build up. A time to weep, and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to get and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to rend and a time to sow. A time to keep silence. And a time to speak, and a time to love, and a time to hate, a time of war, and a time of peace. Solomon begins as he moves into this portion of Scripture to talk, I think, in a sense of one of his frustrations as he looks at life. And remember, he is talking about life under the sun. That's a key phrase. Heaven and life with Christ in eternity don't come into the equation here. Solomon, with all of his wisdom and all of his knowledge, rather views God through the lens of knowledge. He knows about God and the greatness of God and the sovereignty of God, but he lacks so much the focus David had of affection. When David related to the same God, David loved his God with all of his heart, and David was willing to resign the things he didn't understand in life into the hands of God and trust God with those things because he knew the love of God and the affection of God. Solomon understands the magnitude and the greatness of God, but he wrestles with questions that David seems to have been able to place into the hands of God and just to consign himself to the fact that God knew better what to do with those things. And Solomon, with all of his wisdom and with all of his understanding now, looks at life, kind of just takes a cross section and talks about the times that are in our lives, the seasons that are in our lives, and the purposes of man contained within those seasons, and almost says, and yet it looks like time runs its own course, you know. And as we read through this list, I think in some ways hard in some ways to accept, because there is a time for each one of these things in our lives. You know, every minute we're 60 seconds closer to the future. 86,400 seconds in a day, 1,440 minutes, 24 hours, whether you're rich, poor, weak, strong, king, pauper, we all have to deal with time the same way. And as Solomon looks at it, he says there's a time for every purpose under heaven. And he begins by saying a time to be born and a time to die. The first thing that he acknowledges is completely outside of our control. You didn't have anything to do with the second that you were conceived. You weren't a contributor. That makes it easy for you to blame your parents for lots of stuff, I understand. But you didn't have anything to do with it. You're being born, and there's a time to die, and it's appointed. And again, David says, all of my days are written out before any of them was formed in Psalm 139. And he seems to be able to rest in that. You know, he says, because he understands the love and the tenderness of God. Solomon looks at the fact that there's a time to be born and a time to die. That's out of my control. So why should I, you know, he analyzes everything in life and he wrestles with it. Whereas David looked at it and saw the beauty of it and said, yeah, you know, and yet, Lord, take me by the hand and lead me me in the way everlasting. So a Solomon here, yeah, there's a time to be born, there's a time to die. And you look around, it comes to some people when they're 14, 15, 16, 20, 30, and other people live to be 91 and say it's because they smoked cigarettes and drank wine all their life. You know, one guy goes to the doctor every 2 days for his whole life, and he's always sick, and he lives to be 70. And another guy, you know, you say that guy wasn't sick a day in his life. Well, he had all the same stuff. He just didn't go to the doctor, and he dropped dead when he was 70. You know, there's a time to be born and a time to die. And immediately, the first two things he talks about are with outside of our control. We really don't have anything to do with it, and it's not our choice. Here we come, and we're in life, and we realize it, and that we didn't ask to be here. And then there's that ultimate point in time when we pass through the veil, and that, by the way, is outside of our decision-making process also. There's a time to plant and a time to pluck up. Man cooperates with that, with those seasons. There's a time to kill, and there's a time to heal. There's a time to break down and a time to build up. We see that in urban renewal. Man always breaking down, building up, tearing down what's old, building up what's new. It takes place in our life. It takes place all around us. The crimes we see, a time to kill. There's a time to heal. And in regards to those things, there's a time then to weep. If there's a time to kill, if there's a time to heal, if there's a time to break down and build up, and then also in response to those things, there's a time to weep, and there's a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance. And these things are known to all of us here this evening, every one of us. You know, there's the time when there's the day of the funeral parlor, and it's an appointed time, and all of us face it. It's I'd say one of the strangest things in life is death, as far as I'm concerned. You go there to the viewing, and it seems like death visits our door very seldom, at least in this country, and usually it's very ordered and it's proper, and we go to the funeral parlor, and this person passes off the scene, and what a strange visitor, death, when it comes. But it comes, and there's a time to laugh and rejoice and to dance. Our wedding receptions, and you know, these things come in life, and sometimes we wish they wouldn't come. But again, Solomon wrestles with their coming and their going, and says, you know, there's a time for this and a time for that and a time for this, and he almost sees it running out in procession outside of his own control. He says there's a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. Those of you who have just been to Israel with us understand that. There's a time to embrace, a time to affirm someone, to tell someone you love them. There's a time to draw them close, a husband, a child, a wife, or a friend. There's a time for affirmation, and there's a time to refrain from embracing. There's a time of confrontation. There's a time even in the church when in the life of another believer, it's not time to embrace. It's a time to stand back and to challenge. To say you're in sin, or you're blowing it, or, you know, there's a proper time for each. There's a time to get, and there's a time to lose. That has to be accepted also. Sometimes you see people in a relationship, or a loved one passes out of their life, and they can't accept that there's a time to lose, and they ruin the rest of their lives, grieving, or mourning, or wrestling, or why did this happen to me, or they end up bitter. The way life comes is there's a time to get and to receive, but there's a time to lose too. That's life. It's, you know, Solomon is looking at this vast cross section of life and evaluating it and saying these things come to every one of us. And again, it seems to bother him that they're beyond control as he looks at it. There's a time to keep, and there's a time to cast away. You apply that to your attic or your garage. Sorry to say, there's just a time when to throw stuff away. There's a time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence. What a hard lesson that is. How many times do we stand around and say, I wish I'd have never said that, but once it's out, it's gone. I mean, there's no reeling it back in. Proverbs 31, the woman there, in her wisdom, it says the law of kindness is upon her tongue. Sometimes that's not to say anything. Sometimes the law of kindness is to be quiet, not because whatever you would say wouldn't be kind. a time to keep silence and there's a time to speak up. And how many times have we said, man, I wish I'd have said something when we didn't? So there's a time in life to keep quiet, and there's a time when you should open your mouth and say what's true. There's a time to love, thank God, and there's a time to hate also. And we all know it. There's a time of war, sad to say, and there's a time of peace. And Solomon's sitting back and saying, there's a time for every purpose under heaven. As I look at this busy world, you know, from his perspective, there was war, there was peace, there was hating, loving, killing, rejoicing, dancing. He looked at life, and he always marvels at the vanity of it all. Where does it all go? Rich or poor, you know, young or old, strong or weak, these things come across all of our lives. And he says in verse 9, what profit hath he that works in all of his labor? What profit is there, really? You go through these experiences in life of pain, of suffering, of joy, of laughter, and life comes and it goes, and when it all went by, what profit was there in all of it? And again, he's taking an awful depressing point of view. I have seen the travail which God has given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. And he says, he hath made all things beautiful in his time. Of course, the question is, are we yielded? Again, the potter and the wheel, as we're on the wheel turning, and there's laughing and crying and hating and loving and rejoicing and weeping, and we're exercised by the very things of life that God allows to come across our path. If we yield to those things trusting, then he, you know, the potter can mold the clay. If the clay is resistant, then it becomes marred. And Solomon looks at it all and says, well, he makes all things beautiful in his time. And also he has set the world in their heart, speaking of men, eternity, that is, in the heart of man. And yet, he says, no man can find out the work of God that he makes from the beginning to the end. So he comes kind of to the end of this beginning movement, and he says, all these things that are happening in life, and he says, as I look around, he said, God's the one who has everything under control. In his time, and I think that's a frustration to Solomon, in his time, he makes everything work the way he wants it to. Proper would be a good translation, beautiful there. He makes all things proper the way they should be in his time. And he says, yet he set eternity in the heart of man. You know, even your unsaved friends and relatives, they end up looking around at some point and saying, what's the purpose of it all? Why am I here? What's the purpose of life? Man has a much different concept within than the animal kingdom does. And God, in light of all of his work, then, and Solomon finds this frustrating, has set eternity in the heart of man. We wonder, what is there after this life? You know, we're drawn to all these books like, you know, people in their hospital beds that see, you know, this light, and they hear music, and then all of our hearts, we go, ah. And I think personally that's one of the greatest deceptions the enemy's pulling off of the human race. Because, you see, if he can convince us all that when we die, whatever state we're in, repentant or unrepentant, we're all going to see a beautiful light that's going to lead us down a tunnel and hear beautiful music. You know, it's almost portrays this nebulous afterlife where spirits go, and you know, that's not at all the biblical picture, and it's not at all the truth. And yet man buys it because he has eternity in his heart. I mean, that's why the National Enquirer and some of these publications can sell what they sell, because we're caught up with the mystical and that which is beyond this world, and flying saucers and babies born with tattoos and dogs that talk, and you know, well, there's got to be something beyond this world. We're all hoping that there really is. You know, thank God that Jesus Christ has come into our life, and we've got the picture clear. But eternity is in the heart of man. He's searching for more than. I remember my generation with LSD. You know, you're reaching beyond, trying to expand and understand that there's more. And there is. And it's interesting. Paul says, yet in the ages to come, he'll still be revealing his grace and his glory to us. That's already in our hearts now, but we'll never evidently realize it completely, the things of God, because they're infinite, will always be finite. Now, he says, I know that there is no good in them, the days of man, that is, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of his labor. It is the gift of God. Now, the conclusion he continues to come through as he works through all these processes in his mind is there's nothing really better for a man to eat and drink and be merry, is what he's saying. You come on this planet, you sweat, you work, you live, you die, and the best thing that can happen to you is while you're here is if you enjoy your life, you enjoy your wife, your kids, your home, you enjoy your refrigerator, and pretty narrow view of what life's all about. But he says, really, if you can do that, that's the gift of God, because he's going to say, I see kings and rich men who are eaten up with ulcers and don't enjoy anything, though they have everything, and I see the poor people without anything, and yet in their want, they enjoy life. And he says, it's not fair, because I see, he says, I see the man that works for a living, he sleeps good at night, and the man that's extremely rich doesn't sleep at night because he's worried about where the stock market is. He tosses and turns all night on his bed. And he says, they both die like the dog. So he says, I guess the best thing for man is that while he is alive, that he can enjoy his labor, to eat and to drink. But certainly, he doesn't say it's wonderful to be doleful. Some Christians are like that. Some guys, when they pray, you ever hear these guys, oh, most heavenly Father. Right away I went out of there. You know what I mean? He doesn't say anything good about being doleful. He says, when it boils down to it, to enjoy life, to be joyful, to enjoy the fruit of your labor, that is the gift of God, he says. I know that whatsoever God does, it will be forever. It's established. We give up, but his work is established. Nothing can be put to it, and nothing can be taken from it. And I thank God for that when I think of the cross. And God doeth it that men should fear him. God does what he does that we should be in reverence. That which hath been is now. Now this is a pretty remarkable perspective. That which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been, and God requires that which is past. He says, there ain't anything new. That which hath been is now, and that which is to come hath already been. We're talking about the God who is and was and is to come, where he is. All three of those things are in one place. A.W. Tozer makes a great point, and he says, that is our is, was, and is to come. It's not God's, because where he is, was, and is to come. But from our perspective, it's our is, was, and is to come in relationship to God. He dwells in the eternal now. And he said, that which hath been is, that which is coming, God already knows, and he's going to require all things that have gone past. Nothing has slipped by his notice. He says, and moreover, I saw under the sun the place of judgment. Now he says, he talks about the futility of life. It just seems to be going around. Now in the place of judgment, he said, and evidently, as he looks at that, he must think, well, there's a time for every purpose under heaven. He even applies it to injustice and so forth, and oppression we're going to see. He says, moreover, I saw under the sun the place of judgment, that wickedness was there. He's talking about the court system. Sounds like he's living today. Man's judicial system, he says, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. And of course, we see that around us today, how corrupt the court systems can be, and how they can hand out a severe sentence to somebody who wants a protest in front of an abortion center and put them away for years, and somebody else who wants to do something stupid and disrupt church services or do whatever they want to do, they get off the handle. And you look and you say, where's the justice? Or how can this guy that, he's up for rape the third time, how come he's out in a year and a half? Or how come, here's a guy, a kiddie porn guy who has molested little children and he gets off, he doesn't even get sentenced. And we look at it and it irks us. Solomon says, I've seen it, there's a time for every purpose under heaven. God seems to have everything under control within the framework of all that. He said, I looked at the place of judgment, the court system, and he said, there was wickedness there. And I looked in the place of righteousness, and there was iniquity there. And he says, look, verse 17, so I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. There is a time for every purpose and for every work. So he says, ultimately, I know they're not getting away with it, because he said there's a higher court. Thank God. And he says, and when I look at that, I think there's a day coming and I wouldn't want to be in their shoes when it comes. wouldn't want to be in mine either. And I thank God I won't be. Jesus was in my shoes. But when judgment comes, I'll be in his sandals. And his righteousness will be upon me. But there is a day coming. I mean, that is our consolation. And I don't think it's far away, by the way. As we look at the injustice we see, and as we look at the things that are wrong, and as we look at the things that really eat at us, and we know that they're so wrong, you know, and yet we feel so helpless so much of the time because they're beyond our control. When I see it here in church, and the families that get caught in a divorce process or fighting over the children, you get stuck in a system where you feel so helpless because you can't do anything about it, you know. All your money runs down the drain, and they make decisions that you can't come back against, but our consolation is that we know in the not too distant future there's a higher court, and there are no appeals at that court, and the judge there doesn't have to wait for the jury to make up their mind because he knows the story. And Solomon knows that much, but certainly, like all of the Jewish writers, he expected that judgment to be on the earth. We're looking for the blast of a trumpet. And I said in my heart concerning the estate of the sons of men that God might manifest them, and that they might see that they themselves are beasts. So Solomon says, you know, I prayed that God would also make plain to man for him to see that he's just a beast also. And aside from the new birth, that's true. That which befalleth the sons of men befalleth the beasts. Even one thing befalleth them, as the one dieth, so dieth the other, yea, they have all one breath, so that man hath no preeminence above the beast. Now, that's without the new birth, of course, for all is vanity. So he said, you know, I pray that God would make manifest the sons of men, that they're, you know, they're living on this planet with the cows that are grazing, and in regards to mortality and so forth, they're no better than the beast. We prove that much of the time. One thing that's interesting is most of the laboratory work that's done where scientists are trying to find out about behavior and so forth, they use rats to figure out what human beings are like and what they're going to do. I think it's interesting that the rat is usually the animal scientists study to discover things about ourselves. In the book of Genesis, it's interesting, in the creation account, again, it uses the word bara three times to create something from nothing. And God made the heavens and the earth. God created them. He made them from nothing. There was nothing existing. And he created something from nothing. Then as he goes on and separates the land from the seas and even the plant life and the trees and so forth, he doesn't create them from nothing. He creates them from the elements that are in the ground. The plants and so forth are made from that which already existed. Then when it comes to animal life, he creates the animal from the dust of the ground, but then it says, the word bara again, he created them a living soul. So consciousness, God creates from nothing. He brings it into existence. So the animal realm is a step above the plant realm. And, you know, the plant is stationary. It doesn't, as far as we know, it doesn't think. I mean, scientists are spending millions of dollars to tell us that plants like music and so forth. But I think there's better things they could be spending money on. But then consciousness, the next level of existence. God created the animals a living soul. He gave them consciousness. And we have that. We have, like the plants, like the animals, we have a body that's made of the earth. The same 17 elements that are in the dirt or make up our body. Then we have the second stage of creation, which is a consciousness. Man has that. And then the third time he uses the word, it says, let us create man in our image, that God created man in his own image and likeness. And he, again, he took something, he created man in such a way that had never existed before. It's the step above the animal plane to where we have a physical body, we have a consciousness, and then man was a living spirit that separated him from the animal realm. And he was conscious of God. Eternity was in his heart. He had fellowship with God. The animals went according to their migratory patterns. They went, you know, they had instinct, but they didn't have reason. And they didn't have choice like man did. They didn't have that fellowship with God. Now, of course, when Adam sinned, he died spiritually. He didn't die physically. He lived to be 900 years old. His soul didn't die. He still had reason. But the world, as we look at it today, we see man really governed by the flesh. Man has consciousness. He can think, he can reason. It says that in the creation, as he sees it in Romans 1, there's a witness to him that there's eternal Godhood and power, that any man that uses his right mind can say, well, I know there's a supreme being by the things I see around me. But man in that state, in the fallen state where the spirit is dead, is controlled by the flesh. So he uses all of his reason to figure out how he can get into bed with the next girl or the next guy. He uses all of his reason to figure out how he can buy drugs. He uses all of his reason to figure out how he can get money, because that'll secure all kinds of things for him. And really the flesh determines man's consciousness. And it's as we come to Christ and we're born again, that which is born of the spirit is spirit, the spiritual part of man is brought back to life again as we ask forgiveness and Christ touches us and he brings us back again to life. Then there's a big difference between man and beast. Solomon, as he's looking around at humanity, saying, I wish God would let man know that in many ways there's no difference at all between him and the beast. Man has no preeminence over the beast. We know that that's not true because of the new birth. You know, God didn't send any, you know, we're gonna, let me read the rest of the verses here. All go to one place, all are of the dust, all turn to dust again. We know they don't all go to one place. Who knows? Your Bible, I think the NIV says, if. Who knows the spirit of man that goes upward and the spirit of the beast that goes downward to the earth? Now, does this mean that your dogs won't be in heaven? I hate to tell you that. Oh, come on, guys. We're not, you know, it's not like heaven's going to be a bummer because the dog's not there. You know, there's some people that heaven wouldn't be heaven if dogs were there. You know, they don't like dogs. There are going to be better things there. We know there's horses, those white horses. We know there's cherubim. There's some creatures there. But when your dog dies, you can believe what you want. I mean, God is loving, but it seems Solomon hints at the spirit of man returns to the creator and the life of the beast returns to the dust. And the whole idea is, what preeminence has man over the beast? There was never a little doggy that died anywhere on the cross for your dogs, that they would have redemption. They're in a fallen state. The preeminence is that God has called us his sons and his daughters. There is preeminence of man over the beast. God has put all the kingdom of the beast in subjection to man and told man to subdue it and take dominion over it. We are created in the image and in the likeness of God, and there is a great preeminence of man over the beast. And that he would call us his sons and daughters and give his only son for us that we might have life. Now again, Solomon's writing from a pretty depressing perspective as he's writing here. Who knows, he says, whether the spirit of man goes upward, whether the spirit of the beast goes downward. Wherefore I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion. For who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? Now, of course, Christ did that for us. You know, what a depressing thing it would be for us this evening if we didn't know what was coming as Christians. I mean, even it says, as often as we do break this bread and drink this cup, we do show forth the Lord's death until he comes. That's an integral part of our faith. The second coming is tied closely to everything that we believe. If we didn't know what was coming, man, it would be depressing. You know, Jesus said, I've told you these things ahead of time so that when you see them, you'll know that I'm at the very door. He warned us. He didn't leave us, even in this world, of the signs of the times. He didn't leave us ignorant of those things. And more than that, he's told us to set our affections on things above, and he's described those things to us. And remarkable, again, one of my favorite chapters in all the Bibles, Revelation 21, as we see that city with the streets of gold and the walls of jewels, and we look at eternity to come, and he allows us in our hearts to glance into it. I think it's interesting that John there in Revelation 21 says, that he was taken to a high mountain and he saw the holy city Jerusalem coming down. You know, it's almost like Jesus understands firsthand, because Satan tempted him, that Satan kind of takes us to a high mountain and he shows us all the kingdoms of this world and all the glory and all the pleasure of them, and basically says, if you'll bow down and worship me, I'll give them to you. And Jesus knows that that is something every day that we face in the world, and that it wears on us. And that it's way more tangible. You see, you know, we're going through this process of there's a time to be born and a time to die, a time to be healthy, a time to be sick, a time to mourn, a time to weep. And as we're grinding our way through this world, you know, Satan is often telling us, well, you know, God doesn't love you. Jesus doesn't love you. God loved you. Why would your child just have died? Or if God really loved you, why would this be happening in your life? Or if God really loved you, why would he let your daughter marry that guy? Maybe you're thinking at the wedding reception. You know, whatever. But the Bible is clear about our future. And it lays ahead of us as we're going through these things in life. You know, right at the end of the Bible, the last chapter, John is taken up to leave us. The most important, very last thing for God to leave for you and I to gaze at is that holy city one day where we're going to make our abode and we're going to be together. We're going to live there, and we're going to walk its streets together. We'll walk through the park together. We're going to eat the fruit from the tree together. We're going to drink of the river of life together. You know, how sad Solomon, the wisest man that ever lived, had so little faith. The wisest man that ever lived saying, who shall bring him man to see what shall be after him? What a privilege it is that you and I see and understand in some ways more than the wisest man that ever lived. So he says, I returned again. He begins to look again. I returned again and I considered all the oppression that are done under the sun. Now, a time for every purpose. Now he's saying, I looked and there was oppression. And that's hard for us to deal with. Behold, the tears of such that were oppressed, and they had no comforter. And on the side of their oppressors there was power. But they had no comforter. Again, we were very fortunate to live in the country we live in. Many of the countries in this world are ruled by a tyrant. And they're wealthy, they have military power, and they treat their subjects in their country however they want to. And you see people with disease, you see them dying and starving, you see them oppressed. And they have kids just like we do, and they have heartache just like we do, and you look at their tears, and you look at their starving bodies on TV. We almost become desensitized to it sometimes, I think. But Solomon says, I looked and I saw the oppression that was on earth, and I saw that often in the hand of the oppressor there was power, and there was nobody to comfort those that were oppressed. And yet he's looking at, again, at this cycle of time to be born, time to die. There's a time for every purpose under heaven. Again, David was much different in that he would consign these things to the God who he loved. Look what Solomon says in light of that. He says, wherefore, in light of this oppression, I praised the dead, which are already dead, more than the living, which are yet alive. What a depressing view. Listen to this. Yea, better is he than both they, you know, better is he that hasn't been born than those who are alive and those that are already dead. The reason is, who hath not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. So he says, the guy who hasn't been born yet is the guy to be envied, because even the people that are alive and the people that are dead have both passed through this world and seen the impression and everything. And he says, to be envied is the guy that hasn't even come into it yet. Again, I considered all the travail. He's going to talk about labor and work. And every right work. For this is man, this a man is envied. The NIV makes it nice and clearer that even the work of man, what we give ourselves to, springs from envy is the idea. You know, the whole idea of a catalog is based on covetousness. And you look at the United States, and the poor guy that lives in the ghetto gets the same catalog at his front door as the guy who lives in the mansion. And it's the same temptation. It's the same thing that lays in front of us, you know. And you look at somebody else who just got a red Camaro, and then you want to get a red Camaro, you know. Or you look at somebody else that just got a BMW, and you say, well, I'm going to get a Porsche, you know. And he says, when I look at the labor of men under the sun, he said, I see that a lot of it just springs from envy. We look at what somebody else has, what's happened in their life, and we decide we want the same thing or we want better, he says. This also is vanity and is vexation of spirit. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. And it's hard to tell, I think, what he means, and there's a discrepancy here, as he says, the fool at least sits back and folds his hand and eats his food. Better is a handful that the fool has with quietness than both hands full with travail and vexation of spirit. Loneliness he begins to look at. Then I returned and I saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone, and loneliness is a cruel, cruel thing. There is one that is alone, and there is not a second. By the way, I don't think anybody should be lonely who's in the church. As we come to Thanksgiving and as we come to Christmas, if you know someone who doesn't have a family and someone who doesn't have is not going to spend the holidays with somebody, make it a point to get them into your house. Don't leave them alone. Loneliness is a really tough thing. Over the holidays in the winter is when suicide is always at its highest point. And Solomon's going to talk about loneliness. As the body of Christ, we should really work hard that at least those that Christ has brought here to fellowship with us shouldn't have to face that. There is one who is alone, and there is not a second. Yea, he has neither child nor brother, and yet there is no end to all of his labor. Neither is his eye satisfied with riches, and neither says he, for whom am I laboring? And for whom do I bereave my soul for good? This is also vanity. So he says, even a lonely man, and I look at him, he doesn't have an heir, he doesn't have a son to give it to, he doesn't have a brother to share it with, and yet he never rests in his labor, trying to accumulate more, and he says he never stops to ask himself, why am I killing myself working day and night? Why don't I take a vacation? Why don't I take a month off and watch football every day and eat hoagies 3 times a day, or he says even this is vexation. I look at a guy who's lonely, he doesn't have an heir to leave his estate to, he doesn't have anybody he's working for, and yet he's never satisfied with his labor, and it's only vexation. Two in regards to that are better than one, because they have a good reward. There's more profit, two working together for their labor, and if they fall, one can lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falls, for he hath not another to help him up. And by the way, there's no lone rangers in the body of Christ. Every joint, every ligament supplies. You know Christians like that, that say, well, they don't need anybody. They don't need church. Usually they're the kind of Christians who like to go to the park and smoke a joint. And, God is so wonderful, and I don't need the church, and I don't need other believers. And woe unto the guy who falls when he's alone and there's nobody there to lift him up. And you know, funny thing, I've seen God separate people like that. They become critical, or they're always pointing the finger. They become so miserable, no other believers like to be around them. And there are times when God will take a person like that and separate that person out to where when they fall, all of a sudden they're all alone. There's nobody there. And it's there often like the prodigal. They look up and they realize their loneliness. But the Lord, Solomon here says, woe to the guy who's alone when he goes down like that and he falls and there's no one there to lift him up. Verse 11, he says, if two lie together, at least they have heat. Now, this is before baseboard heat and radiators. And how can one be warm alone? If one prevail against him, two shall withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. A beautiful verse. A rope with three strands is stronger than one with two, is the idea. Better is a poor. Now, he talks about the futility of fame and reaching position in life, and many of us are bent on that. Better is a poor and wise child than an old and foolish king who will no more be admonished. I wonder if he's thinking of himself as he writes this. For out of prison he cometh to reign, the young wise man, whereas also he that is born in his kingdom becomes poor. I considered all the living which walk under the sun with the second child that shall stand up in his stead. Now, this is hard to understand. What I think he's saying is, It's better to be a young and wise child than an old and foolish king, because he said, out of prison, from nowhere, this young, wise man can arise and come to a place of prominence in a kingdom where other men just end up being poor. And he says, as I look at all the living that walk under the sun, they're more inclined to follow the second man, this young, wise ruler, that shall stand up in his stead in the place of the old foolish king. And there is no end of all the people, even of all that have been before them, and they also that come after shall not rejoice in him, in the young man that's taken his place. Surely this is all vanity and vexation. So what he says is, even as I look at promotion, as I look at coming to a certain place in life, he said, it's better to be young and wise and poor than it is to be an old foolish king who won't be admonished anymore, because the young and wise man can arise even from prison to become a ruler, maybe thinking of Joseph in Egypt or something. And he can arise to become the ruler, and the people will follow the young, strong ruler and who comes up in the place of the first king. And yet, he says, with the multitudes of people that come and go, as the next generation comes, this young ruler, he'll grow old like the first one, and the people that will no longer be pleased in him anymore. And it's all vanity of vanities, he says. Time to be born, time to die. You know, it's this process. So even, you know, we look at our movie stars, and we look at our people that, you know, that arise to a position in life, and we admire them, and it seems as though time goes on and they die, and my kids at home don't know who Tyrone Power or Gary Cooper or, you know, when I talk about some of the old black and white films I might love, those guys have come and gone and bit the dust, and my kids at home don't even know who they are, you know. Or they try to talk to me about some of the things they think about, I don't know who they're talking about. I remember the first time my kids talked about the new Kids on the Block, I thought somebody had moved in. And I even know, of course, now who they are, but they knew who they were before I did. They don't know who Ringo Starr is, I had to say, or John Lennon, or, you know, Wilson Pickett, or... they don't know what they're missing. Poor kids. Chapter 5. Now he's talking about now going into the house of God. He's going to talk about, I think, the whole concept of riches and again elevation in life. He says, keep thy foot when thou goest into the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools. And the sacrifice of fools that he's going to talk about as he goes down here is making foolish vows. You know, and we all make vows. Oh, Lord, if you just give me the job, I'll do this and I'll do that. You know, normally, the thing we have to watch ourselves, when we make a vow, we're bargaining with God. Usually, it's our vows are our bargaining chip. I promise I'll do this if you'll do this. And, Lord, I'll never go there again. Or I'll never smoke one of those again. Or I'll never, you know, just get me out of this jam and I'll never do this again. And we make our vows. And he says, look, you know, better to hear. I mean, the fact that God gave us two ears and one mouth should be a clue to all of us that we shouldn't talk twice as much as we hear, that we should hear. We should hear twice as much as we talk. I mean, we'd look funny with a mouth on each side and an ear hanging in the front, wouldn't we? But that's the way we live sometimes. Be ready to hear rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they consider not that they do evil. To obey is better than to sacrifice. Solomon, I'm sure, had heard this. David heard it through Samuel. Solomon heard tremendous things from David, his father. To hearken is better than the fat of rams. Joel says, rend your hearts and not your garments. You know, Psalm 51, David, talking about his sin there, says the acceptable sacrifice before God is a broken and contrite spirit. And God doesn't take any pleasure in the fat of bulls and rams and so forth. So Solomon, at least, is saying, when you come into the temple now, you know, be quick to hear, listen, and learn, and know that God's more interested in your heart than some foolish vow. Be not rash with your mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God. The reason? Because God is in heaven and you're on earth. That's a perspective, isn't it? Therefore, let thy words be few. For a dream comes through the multitude of busyness, and the fool's voice is known by the multitude of his words. He wrote the opposite in Proverbs. He says, even a fool is considered wise when he keeps his mouth shut. When he opens it, he removes any shadow of a doubt. When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which you have vowed. Better is it that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay. And Jesus said that. Let your yea be yea and your nay be nay. Nothing more than that, because anything more than that comes from sin. You know, you don't have to, you know, if a guy's coming to you saying, lend me $10. I promise I'll give it back. I'll promise. You know, I'll do this. I'll do that. If he's so good for the $10, why he's got to make all these promises and vows and everything to get it back from you, you know. It says not to make any pledges there. You'd never believe that when you see some of these televangelists on TV. Pledge this, pledge that, pledge this. You think they never read that Jesus said don't make any pledges, you know. Well, maybe they never did. Better that you shouldn't make vows than you should make them and not keep them. Now look at verse 6. Suffer not. Now that's your job. Allow not. Don't let your mouth cause your flesh to sin. And man, have I seen and done. I'm an expert not only by observation but by practice. Mouths that cause people's flesh to sin. I mean, you open your mouth once in a wrong instant and there's a fist in it, or your fist is in somebody else's face, or how often have you, you know, thought, I wish I'd have never said that, or you say something to your relatives and 20 years later they're still reminding you of it, you know. James tells us in chapter 3 that the tongue is set on fire of hell, of Gehenna, and it destroys the whole round of existence. I mean, you have to realize that abortion is promoted by the tongue, that homosexuality is promoted by the tongue, that all kinds of protest and war and killing, you know, the tongue. Satan, his main way into our existence is through the tongue, and he promotes things in the hearts and minds of man through the tongue, through communication, through language, you know. And he says here, don't let, you know, your tongue's the only part of your body that comes in its own cage, and yet all you have to do is keep the cage shut. Yeah. It's amazing, though, isn't it? Don't allow your mouth to cause your flesh to sin. Neither say thou before the... Now, this is the messenger, evidently, in the temple area, that it was an error. Don't try to tell the guy in the temple that's collecting your vow, I didn't really mean to say it, you know. It's too late then. Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thine hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there are also diverse vanities. But fear thou God, reverence God. If you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perverting of judgment and justice in a province, marvel not at the matter. For he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. Praise God. There's a higher court than the Supreme Court. Moreover, the profit of the earth is for all, and the king himself is served by the field, the same way the poor man is. He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver. Strange, isn't it? Nor he that loveth abundance with the increase. This also is vanity. If your God is money, you know, you look at some of these men, Donald Trump and some of these guys, and you think, why do they have to have another motel? Why do they have to have another yacht? You know, why do I have to buy out this guy? But, you know, you think, if I had $50 million, I could be happy. You know what I mean? I wouldn't have to get involved in anything else or gamble anything, you know. Don't you think it would be enough if you had $50 million? You put it in the back and you live on the interest, you know. Well, maybe I'm a fool that's content to sit back and eat his meat, as Solomon says. But I look at some of these guys and I think they're never satisfied. It seems like the more you get, you know, it almost becomes a power thing. Then it's beyond money. It's beyond possession. It becomes something more. And there's no satisfaction with those who make money their God. When goods increase, Here's the problem. They are increased that eat them. You get more, you got to invest more, you got to buy restaurants, you got to invest in real estate, then you got to hire an accountant, then you got to hire a lawyer, and pretty soon everybody's eating your money. Then, you know, the system, the bigger you get, the more important you get, the more money you have, the more people you got to pay. And it's the problem with government. It goes bankrupt. The bigger it gets, the more you have to organize it. And the more you organize it, the more people you get involved. The more people you get involved, the more you get stabbed in the back and ripped off. And Solomon, speaking from experience, by the way, he says that his provision for one day at his table was 30 measures of flour. That's enough. Two loaves a person, that's enough to feed 11,000 people a day. This is at his table. Yeah, I think my house is crazy with four kids when you hear this. 3 measures of meal, that's 600 bushels. That's enough for 20,000 loaves a day. 10 fatted oxen, 20 oxen of the pasture, I guess they're thinner. 100 sheep, besides harts and roebucks and fallow deer and fatted fowl, that's enough for 1.5 pounds of meat a day for 14,000 people. He says the more money you get, the more people are eating at your table, the more there is to worry about. The daily provision at the court of Cyrus. Now that sounds extravagant. The Cyrus and the Persians, listen to this. At the table of Cyrus, every day they slaughtered 400 sheep, 300 lambs, 100 oxen, 30 horses. Yeah, well, you know, 30 deer, 400 geese, 100 young geese, 300 pigeons, 600 small fowls, 3,750 gallons of wine, 75 gallons of new milk and 75 gallons of sour milk. Well, I guess he had all kinds of people at his table eating horses and sour milk. But Solomon says, you know, when goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And he spoke from experience. Imagine as he looked around his table, he must have thought, man, some of these guys are really freeloaders, man. What good is there to the owners thereof, except is saving the beholding of them with their eyes? In other words, it says, when you increase to that point, what good is it to the owners except to have to keep your eye on it all the time, is what he says, literally. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet. He comes home from the field, he puts away his shovel, he eats his dinner, and he goes, oh man, my back aches, my arm aches, it feels so good. Ah, he zonks out and snores. He said, you know, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not allow him to sleep. Solomon, the richest man that ever lived, looks around and says, the guy who's laboring in the fields got the edge on me. There is a sore evil that I have seen under the sun. Now, he's told all this is about riches. Namely, riches kept for the owners thereof to their hurt. So he says, I've seen some rich people try to hoard their riches instead of investing them. You know, the Bible tells us that we should be investing in the kingdom. You can't take it with you, but you can send it ahead, believe me. Jesus tells the parable about the unjust steward and how when he got caught by his master, he called in the master's debtors and he said, how much do you owe my master? And one guy said, 1,000. He said, quick, write 500. How much do you owe my master? I owe your master 500 talents. He says, quick, write 250. And he cut everybody's bill in half. And he says, what he did was he made friends so that after he was fired, he knew his master was going to throw him out. He had all these people who owed him. And he says, the people of this generation, worldly people, are wiser than the sons of light sometimes. Because we also have an investment program. Look how people in this world work and lay up and they connive and they scheme and they do people's favors. One hand washes another so that, you know, like this unjust steward, he cut everybody's bill in half so that when he got thrown out, he could come to the guy's house and say, hey, I saved you $500. How about putting me up for a few nights, whatever. And Jesus says that we should use the mammon of unrighteousness and lay it up so that it receives us into everlasting habitations. In other words, you help your neighbor or you invest in someone's life, and as you step into glory, that person's going to be there and say, man, you know, you helped me out so much, you know, look at these eternal rewards. And that we should understand as children of light how to invest also. Because there's an investment that we can make that pays dividends throughout eternity. Solomon here says, I looked at one, you know, there's one kind of evil I've seen other son is a rich man who hoards everything to his own hurt. He ends up dying of ulcers. All he does every day is worry about his money, worry about what's going to happen to it, worry about where it's going to go, you know, worry about his son who wants to spend the rest of his life playing tennis or something, who's a nerd, you know, after he's built a corporation his whole life, you know. He says that's one evil I've seen under the sun. And he said, another one in verse 14 is those where riches perish by evil. Someone steals your money, and then he begets a son, and there's nothing in his hand to leave for his heir. So he says, I've seen the wealthy that try to hoard their wealth to their own destruction. I've seen the wealthy who lose everything they have by evil, and they have nothing to pass on to the next generation. As he came forth of his mother's womb, naked, shall he return to go as he came, and shall take nothing of his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. And that's so untrue, by the way. We can take with us the fruit of our labor. The New Testament teaches that clearly. Every man will be rewarded according to his labor. That's not salvation. Salvation is a free gift. You can never earn it or deserve it. Salvation is a free gift. Eternal life has to be given to us. We could never deserve it. We're not worthy. Don't spend the rest of your life walking around looking in a mirror saying, I'm not worthy. Settle it once and for all. You're not worthy. Just settle it right now. Say, I'm not worthy. If you're not worthy, please raise your hand. Let me see everybody who's not worthy to go to heaven forever. Thanks. So stop worrying about it right now. You're not worthy, okay? You never will be worthy. It's a free gift. Jesus did it for you because you can never do it. But there will be rewards. Some of us will receive our rewards, wood, hay, and stubble. They'll be burned up. But other rewards will endure the fire and the things we do for Christ. There is a labor in this world that we can labor for Christ's sake and lay up eternal rewards that are there for us that will never perish. So Solomon, though, as he's looking at life, you know, he says, what's this? Well, you know, he said, naked we come, naked we're going to go. And there's, obviously that's true. But he says you can't take anything with you of all your labor, which is untrue. And I don't think we should have that attitude. I think sometimes as Christians we get so beaten down and we get so worn out. I remember a time in my life as a young Christian where I used to think, well, if I commit suicide, will I go to heaven or will I go to hell? You know, and thank God I was too dumb to believe what I believe now. And so I used to sit there and say, look, I don't want to wake up tomorrow, God. Just let me, you know, I'll be the least in your kingdom. Because I read in a few places he talked about the least in his kingdom. And I thought, well, that could be me. Just, you know, I don't want to wake up tomorrow. Just let me sit inside the golden gate. I'll slide in and I'll be right against the wall. Give me a blanket and a golden cup, whatever your beggars have there in your street. And I'll be the least. I'll be the lowest guy in the totem pole, just so I don't have to put up with this world anymore. I'll be the eternal beggar in your kingdom. I'll just sit there. It'll be nice. It'll be warm. I'll be happy. It'll be heaven. And I'll beg. I don't care, you know. But Peter says, and he prays, that we might have an abundant entrance into the kingdom of God. You know, we think that way because we don't know what we're dealing with. If we had any concept of what eternity is going to be like and what those rewards will be like and what a glory it'll be to be able to take our crowns and throw them at the feet of Jesus Christ as he sits on the throne, if we had any idea of the glory of the whole scene, I think what better investors we would be spending ourselves and our resources towards the kingdom here in this world. But Solomon, completely depressed, says, you come into the world naked, you go naked, and everything you work for in your life, you leave behind. Nothing goes with you. Verse 16 says, this also is a sore evil, that in all points, as he came, so shall he go. And what profit hath he that hath labored for the wind? All his days also he eats in darkness, and he hath much sorrow and wrath in his sickness. And sickness is a tough one to deal with. Behold, that which I have seen, now he comes to a conclusion again, It is good and beautiful for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all of his labor that he takes under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him, for it is his portion. So if there's one thing good I can see about life is to enjoy it while you're living in it, he says. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth and hath given him power to eat thereof and to take his portion and to rejoice in his labor, this is a gift of God. You know, if God's given you wealth and so forth and you can enjoy it, he says that's a gift of God, because Solomon has seen too many men that are wealthy that don't enjoy it at all. They get ulcers. They jump out of the 31st story of when there's a stock market crash. They're jumping out of Wall Street and splattering all over the street. When there's a guy in Mexico that just got the first chicken he's had in 2 months, and they're all sitting around saying grace, thankful, for dinner. And he says it's God who gives a man's heart the ability to be thankful. Yeah, he's coming to some good conclusions here. This also is the gift of God. You ever see that license plate, we're enjoying our kids' inheritance? You know, that's basically the same idea. For, in verse 20 now, he says, for he shall not much remember the days of his life, because God answereth him in the joy of his heart. What it says is, you know, it's the gift of God that we can enjoy life. If a man has the ability to do that, it's the gift of God, because he says he shall not much remember. He's not going to be, this man is not reflecting on life all the time. Like Solomon, he drove himself nuts. You know, it's like somebody with perfect pitch. It's much better to have relative pitch than it is to have perfect pitch. I hear lots of people say they have perfect pitch. But when you have perfect pitch, I've known a few, you can't listen to an orchestra. It'll drive you out of your mind. Because if there's any dissonance at all, if one violin isn't tuned perfect, that's all you can hear. Your whole orchestra's playing. All you can hear is the one thing that's out, you know. And if you have perfect pitch, you'll go out of your mind when you listen to worship, because we are not all in tune in here when we worship, or you listen to an orchestra. But if you have relative pitch, you know what I mean? It's, you can enjoy things way better. Solomon is a guy, in one sense, that has perfect pitch. God has given him that wisdom. It's supernatural to rule and to make decisions and to analyze things. And as he's looking at life, he says, this man who has the gift of God to enjoy life, one of the reasons is because he doesn't reflect on life all the time. Because that's what was driving Solomon crazy. All he did was reflect on all these things. And he says, rather, God keeps him occupied with the joy of his heart, is what the Hebrew says. So he comes finally to that conclusion again. That if you see a guy, whether he's rich or poor, and he can enjoy the fruit of his labor, that's a gift of God. And I think it is today, too, by the way, as Christians. We should be content. Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 6, if we have clothing and we have a roof over our head and we have food, you know, he says you didn't bring anything in this world, you're not going to take anything with you. And he says the love of money is the root of all evil. Not money, but the love of it. And he says, those who are pursuing it, it's become their God, you know, strike themselves through with many hurtful and painful things. And Solomon's coming to the same conclusion, you know. We come into life screaming, causing a fuss. Somebody's got to take care of us and clean us up. We start to make our way in life and get out of elementary school and high school and start to earn a living, and we start to feel pretty good. Maybe we're in our 20s and 30s, and you can either be enjoying life, having a perspective, certainly as a Christian, looking around, understanding there's going to be more, or you can be 20 and 30 and giving yourself an ulcer, and your hair could be turning gray because you're going to be trying to figure out how to retire at 40. You know, and then you get to 40 and 50, and the prostate starts to go bad, and the hair starts to fall out, and the teeth, and all of a sudden you can see further back than you can forward, and some realities of life start to strike on you. I think Solomon at this point is saying, look, you know, if you can go through this world, you know, of of being born and of dying, a time to be born, time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up, a time to sow, and a time to reap, and a time to gather stones together, and a time to cast away stones, and a time to laugh, and a time to weep, and a time to mourn, and a time to dance. If we can go through this process, he says, God has everything on the wheel under control. He makes all things beautiful in his time, and though it seems marred with injustice in the court system and oppression and these things we wrestle with and people that give their whole life to their riches that disappear out from us, he says, as we pass through, if we can enjoy life, if we can keep from reflecting to the point where we drive ourselves nuts and can be occupied with the joy of our hearts, and that, of course, to us should be Jesus Christ, he says, that's a gift of God. And it is a gift of God in our lives that we sit here this evening and we understand that Christ has paid for our sins. You know, just on this trip to Israel, I get to, with 70 people from church, I get to find out your names. I mean, I see your faces all the time. I get to be friends a little more. But I'm, you know, my consolation is that we have forever. I'm bad with names, but I got eternity to get them all down, you know. And our relationship is just beginning. And so we're passing through. And I enjoy life. I mean, I love my kids. I love my wife. I do enjoy life. I love to live. And yet, I know that there are those times coming. Time to take hold of things and a time to let go of them. Whether it's lives or loved ones or relationships or career or whatever. There's a time to be born, a time to die, and as we go around on this wheel, I'm comforted because I know the one who has all things under control. And what a gift it is to live with that perspective, to have our eyes open instead of walking in darkness.